Rochelle Farrell connection. I'm Eliza, filling in for Rochelle Farrell, and while she's on vacation, I come to you from the Green Mountain State of Vermont. Today I have a wonderful guest, Alan McCrae, who's here to tell us how we can be proactive in helping to impact earth changes. Welcome, Alan.
Hey, hi. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Well, you're welcome. Tell us, Alan, what's your spiritual development that led you into the process of considering earth changes?
Well, I was pretty much a very focused scientist most of my early academic career. But I got very interested in spiritual experience at Stony Brook during that period when social change was really accelerating in our society. It was like there was a spiritual energy that was motivating people to get involved in social change. And I really experienced that personally, and it led me to get interested in Eastern philosophy and yoga and meditation and then Native American spirituality. And I think it helped balance my life out so that science occupies a portion of my being, but spirituality occupies the other portion.
Yeah. Well, this is an exciting topic that I understand you're going to be talking about. You're going to be giving us the earth changes, impacts, and everything here. So do you want to get started on that?
Sure. Any of the listeners who would like to follow along with this conversation, I threw a web page up that links to many of the online resources that I've drawn from to have this discussion. You can find that web page at www.outdoorfun.com/earth_changes.htm.
Yeah, I'm at that page, and I hope everybody else can get to that page and follow along with us if they'd like to. Why don't you go ahead and tell us, follow your outline if you'd like to, or just go for it.
Okay, sure. Yeah, let's start off a little organized, and then we can kind of segue a little whenever we need to.
Okay.
So the big question is, what do we mean by the earth changes? And I found an excellent quote at a website called Apota that defined it as sudden large-scale catastrophic changes in the geography, geological activity, rotation, or climate of the Earth. Pole shifts and the rising of Atlantis from the sea are two common Earth change scenarios. Such ideas have been popularized by people like Edgar Cayce, Gordon Michael Scallion, Gloria Dale Toy, and Richard Noon.
You really follow the good guys, don't you?
Well, it's like there are people in every field who are consistently putting forth their ideas and their research, and they eventually become very closely linked to that particular field. And so, you know, when you're trying to have a discussion about a field, I feel you should focus on the people who have a lot of weight in that field and
exactly.
People, you know, listen to. One interesting thing is that ideas about the earth changes can be found in many Aboriginal cultures and religions and are studied in the philosophical field of eschatology, which comes from the Greek word meaning last, as in last days or last times or end of history. Aboriginal peoples around the world have lots of earth change prophecies, some of which are quite ancient in origin. Those of you who would like to dig a little deeper, there are three websites listed there, especially the Prophecy Keepers is a three-part series that really delves into many different Aboriginal earth changes philosophies from around the world. But always a good place to start any kind of research is on Wikipedia, which is kind of like humanity's free online encyclopedia. And if you start at that first link on eschatology, they have some great background information and some links to other online resources. One thing that I always like to do in any conversation is to also present the yang to the yin. You know, there are always two sides to every presentation, and let me clarify my thoughts on this, which is that imminent apocalypse myths have resurfaced thanks to charismatic proponents with remarkable regularity throughout documented human history, making one wonder whether some of this is simply a universal psychological archetype with excellent fear-mongering potential for any potential religious or political leader, self-styled prophet, or ambitious electric generator salesman. Those of you who remember the Y2K hysteria and who have friends who and you know who you are, went out and bought electric generators and filled the trunk of your car with food and stored fresh water and batteries and kind of hunkered down for a couple of days, and who were surprised when the world got up the next morning and everything sort of just proceeded as normal. It's important to realize that apocalyptic myths have been around for a long time. In fact, one thing I would like to show you right off the bat, this Abhota info has a wonderful synopsis, a brief history of the apocalypse, going back to, believe it or not, 2800 BC, where an Assyrian clay tablet dating to approximately 2800 BC was unearthed, bearing the words, quote, "Our earth is degenerate in these latter days. They're a sign that the world is speedily coming to an end. Bribery and corruption are common," unquote. When you look through some of this excellent material here, you will see that throughout history, sometimes shortly spaced apart in a mere handful of years, different groups of people have been proclaiming that the apocalypse is imminent. And when you dig a little deeper, you find out that these groups oftentimes have agendas that they are pursuing, in which this kind of fear-mongering gives them, of course, fear is very powerful, gives them some sort of leverage over their fellow man, which they try to use to exploit some sort of agenda. So I want to balance out what we're going to talk about with this idea that we need to be somewhat calm and clear in what we look at and to use some discernment, because we are going to encounter a wide variety of different views on prophecy and on the earth changes and the scientific data behind earth changes.
So are you going to put everybody at ease today, or do you think that this is going to make people more nervous?
I think a little bit of both. I think you're going to see on the easing side that there is honest disagreement of interpretation of data, even amongst scientists, people who are trying to look at data very objectively, are disagreeing on the very data that they're looking at, and that when it comes to prophecies, we see that there is a pattern of predicting millennial catastrophe that goes back into antiquity, and we're all still here. So I think on the relaxing side, you know, we're still here, and there's a lot of gray area. On the side that should make everyone a little nervous, there is a growing body of scientific evidence and a growing sense within each of us that there are very powerful events that are building in our world, and that that are somewhat threatening and that require a enlightened, creative response from us.
Mm-hmm. I think no matter what happens in the world, we should still be trying to take care of the planet, though.
Absolutely. That's really the bottom line. And at the end of this little presentation, we're going to talk about very proactive things that we can do as individuals to make sure that we never encounter any end-time scenario, that,
okay.
that the world goes on as it is meant to go on for billions more years, and that we become responsible stewards for the future by making changes now in the present that will benefit our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren into perpetuity. Just wrapping up this this idea of ancient prophecies versus our current intuition, I think we can all sense that something big is about to happen. You know, anyone who meditates, who prays, who contemplates the world has a growing sense that there are very, very large forces and energies afoot in the world, which have the potential either to bring humanity together as never before onto the same page of wanting to improve the lot of all humans everywhere and respect each other's differences, or to descend into kind of a balkanizing effect of divisions into small tribal and groups and religious groups and economic and political groups that compete ruthlessly for the resources of the world that are increasingly stressed by the rising demand of a huge population of humans, all of whom want those essential resources.
Right.
There's some excellent material about comparisons between the New Age and evangelical Christianity movements, who both have very strong apocalyptic mythologies. And I list two websites there that explore those topics and would give someone some insight into what these different groups are thinking, what the basis of their thoughts are, and how much of that resonates with your own intuition. One interesting thing that I found for this radio show is an article called The Secular Substitute for the Apocalypse that, believe it or not, casts global warming as the environmentalist version of the apocalypse myth. A very articulate article that argues that that environmentalists, in effect, are latching onto the same fear-based energies that New Age and evangelical Christians are attaching themselves to, and are recasting that energy as this fear-based global warming diatribe. So it's a very interesting article that will help balance one's opinion about the motives behind people for the drumbeat of global warming. There was a poll by the Washington Post, ABC News, in September of 2005 that shows that 56% of the American people believe that global warming is occurring, whereas 40% said they are not convinced. It's interesting that two-thirds of all Democrats say that they were convinced that global warming was occurring, but nearly as many Republicans disagree, saying that it's not occurring. So we're divided along political lines about this issue of global warming.
I think if anybody is checking their thermometers and checking, you know, back with what happened here and what happened there, I mean, it's obvious that global warming is happening. I don't know how they can deny it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what the people who are in denial are saying is that accurate climate data is fairly recent, and the ability to observe the Earth with any degree of coverage and accuracy is really only since the age of satellites and getting the EOS system, the Earth Observational System platform in space, to be able to watch the Earth from space with many different instruments to see what is really going on a planetary scale. Because weather is so highly variable, you know, from one region of the Earth to another, that identifying patterns that are long-term and not simply transient is very difficult. There are different ways to interpret even the scientific information that's being found. However, saying that, there is a growing consensus now in the climatology community that indeed global warming is occurring. There are still some debates about what percentage of that is being caused by man-made activities and what percentage is possibly natural phenomena, because the Earth's climate warms and cools constantly throughout recorded time. But the growing consensus is that man's impact on global warming is definitely a major factor and increasing, and that there's no way to take the stored carbon of hundreds of millions of years that is under the ground and dispersing it into the atmosphere without causing global warming. The physics say that there's simply no way to do that we know of. Once you put that carbon back in the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas, you're putting enormous quantities. You're at the same time felling the forests and other green plants that would absorb that carbon dioxide and re-lock it into biological material. So by definition, you must be causing global warming. So I think the debate is finally now coming down to how great is the impact of man, how concerned do we need to be, and what concrete steps can we begin to take as individuals to start to slow this process and restore a better balance between carbon dioxide creation and carbon dioxide integration.
Can you begin to give us some of the things that the people can actually start doing? I'm just so afraid we're going to run out of time, and I want to make sure that you are able to say that, to tell people so that they can prepare and do what they can do to help save the planet.
Sure, definitely. I would say that the first thing is to learn about our planet's various natural systems and develop a mental model of how nature works, and then apply this awareness to understanding both global and local environmental issues. A great first step would be to take some friends to see Al Gore's new movie, An Inconvenient Truth, and discuss the film together over dinner. then take some responsible action for positive political change and improvements in our national and regional public policies. I believe that informed citizens do make a difference, and so that would be a good first step. As a second step, I would say that consumption is often an unconscious political act. Consumers casting votes for which technology, manufacturers, and retailers, they want to survive and prosper. Examine your lifestyle under an environmentally correct microscope and begin to make changes in what you consume, where you purchase your necessities, and which producers you want to reward with your business. What we're talking about a lot here in the mountains of the Smoky Mountains, where I'm located, is as a community, we're considering the many local benefits of CSA, which is community-supported agriculture, especially when it's organic agriculture. And buy as much of your food supply as possible from responsible local organic farmers. What you find is that by supporting them directly and developing a personal relationship with your grower and his family, you help protect your family's health from the many pesticide residues that are found in non-organic produce. You cast your vote for less corporate industrial agriculture and more small-scale, sustainable local organic farming. You keep hard currency circulating in your community instead of going somewhere else. And you help to preserve precious fertile topsoil and keep it out of the hands of misguided developers.
A lot of the problems that I hear people saying is that buying organic is so expensive, they can't afford it. Just
absolutely.
Like using naturopathic medicine
absolutely.
Is
Let me
beyond
tell you
their reach.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a major part of the problem because if it's not cost effective for them, which they're not looking in the long run, their health is affected by this. Their families are affected by this. But they're not seeing that. What price do you pay for your family's health?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Prevention is way more effective than trying to pay for a cure. When I first met my wife, she had children in a previous marriage, and her philosophy, even though she was living pretty close to the bone economically as a single mother, was she wanted to protect her children's health proactively by feeding them organic food and keeping pesticides and other toxic substances out of their bodies, figuring that investing in their health was a lot better than paying for, you know, giving them, you know, toxic food and then paying for health insurance to hopefully come along when they got cancer down the road or
watching them in the hospital die.
Yeah, you know. I mean, I thought that was an incredibly wise choice. In other words, her insurance policy was investing in quality food for her family, securing a clean water supply, trying to purify the air that you breathe. I mean, spending as much time in a healthy environment internally and externally as you can rather than trying to remediate problems down the road.
Exactly.
So that's how I answer that question. You know, you're better off investing in keeping yourself healthy than simply taking what this society dishes out to you, accepting it as being somehow good, healthy food, despite the fact it may be genetically modified, just going along with the flow, and then somewhere down the line finding yourself in a hospital being treated for cancer. And then trying to backtrack and take care of yourself.
And then now deal with the poisons they put in your body to get rid of those diseases.
Oh, man, that much, much more difficult problem than keeping them out in the first place.
Exactly.
One of the other things that got me involved in wanting to understand the environment was I took some of my nieces on a little local hiking trip around my parents' development. And what I had done was I found that there was a pond in the woods between their development and the parkway that no one ever really visited because it was all fenced off, and on the other side, of course, was all this, you know, highway traffic. And you could see it from the satellite, from you know, getting on the Internet and going to those websites where you can see the Earth from space. And so we went out there and looked for this pond, and when we got out there, we found an interesting little microclimate ecosystem, and the first thing that we noticed was there were these gigantic bullfrogs. I mean, some of the biggest bullfrogs I've ever seen anywhere, which at first seemed like it was going to be a hopeful sign, but as we looked more closely, every single one of these frogs was dead. There wasn't a single living one. And when we checked the water, of the pond, there were no living tadpoles in the water.
Oh, no.
And we couldn't believe what we were seeing. You know, that here, the waters of life that are supposed to be so nurturing were killing everything that was, you know, dependent upon them. So we went back to the house, and we got on the internet and we researched it. We found out that a scientist at Stony Brook was studying the decline of amphibians and reptiles and was attributing it to runoff from suburban areas, just like where my parents live, of things like motor oil and antifreeze and lawn chemicals and, you know, all sorts of toxic materials that are a part of everyday middle-class consumer lifestyle that were getting into the environment and were affecting the canary species that are found in water, which, of course, is the basis of life. When you see something like that, you go, oh, my God, you know, what we are doing in our daily life is diminishing the life-carrying capacity of the Earth at its earliest and most fundamental level, which is in water. You know, we're attacking the fundamental element of life on our own planet and causing the death and possible extinction of thousands of species of living things. So it's telling us we're on a wrong path there.
What could you do to get people to actually listen? It seems to me, people that I've talked to, it doesn't affect me. You know, it'll fix itself. You know, ignorant comments like this. It's heart-wrenching to think that people care so little about the place that they live that they would just, you know, well, let it be somebody else's problem.
I mean, I was very blessed. I had a father who took his kids out into nature from time to time. And, you know, we took a microscope with us, and we took slides and eyedroppers and little bottles and stuff. And you know, we went out and we looked at life, you know, and we developed a deep sacred reverence for living things and for forests. And he really instilled that love of God's creation in us. And so that later, when we found out that our lifestyles were damaging this sacred web of life, it made us want to say, well, what can we do to change this, to reverse this? Until people connect once again with the web of life, the way our ancestors were connected, from that place of respect for the plants that you eat, the animals that give their lives so that you can be nourished, to the entire creation of this earth. Oh, I know how I can phrase this. When you see photos of the earth from space, and you see this endless black inky void that is vacuum that varies from unimaginable cold to heat that is just, you know, off the scale, and radiation that is lethal to any living thing almost instantaneously, you realize that we have this precious little lifeboat that is the only place to live for light years in any direction.
Right.
You know, it indicates how utterly sacred this lifeboat is, that in our own solar system we can't find, with the most sophisticated instruments we have, any sign that even the most primitive forms of life exist on any other planet. You know, from Mars being a desiccated, you know, cold desert to Venus being, you know, a surface temperature warm enough to melt most common materials, and every other planet being either full of, you know, toxic gases and ices, or so close to the sun that radiation, you know, heats the planet, you know, to the melting point of metal. You know, I mean,
right.
there's no place else. This is it, folks. You know, if we don't take care of this, generations from now, our ancestors will curse our stupidity, our greed, and our unwillingness to come to the most obvious spiritual conclusion there is, which is that we are a part of a divine and sacred creation that we were given dominion and responsibility over, hopefully because we were wise enough to be able to use our fingers and toes and brains to take care of the garden, not to destroy it. So that's how I would answer that question that you asked about how do you get people to care. They have to make that spiritual connection. I don't care how many books you read, and if you've got crystals and you're burning incense and you got candles on your altar, if you're not out there checking out your fellow living things in this lifeboat of Earth to see how they're doing, and if you're not thinking seven generations ahead about how your actions will impact your great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren, then you're not really a part of the solution. You're still part of the problem.
Exactly. I get very annoyed when I go down the road and I see somebody throwing garbage out of their car. That just annoys me. And then I've heard people say, well, Green Up Day. We have Green Up Day in Vermont. I don't know if you have that in North Carolina or not. But we have Green Up Day, and people have said, well, let them pick it up.
Wow.
It's just sheer ignorance. Absolutely incredible.
How do we get started in that concept? That instead of having a little trash bag in your car and neatly disposing of your trash, the earth is your trash container? What an absurd idea. There's a level of disrespect.
I know.
One's creator that is inexcusable. You know, there's a debate about whether the universe sort of just runs on, you know, natural laws and physics and chemistry, and we can kind of do whatever we're going to do, and whatever punishments come to us are simply the result of processes that we loose in the physical universe that eventually poison the nest that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
There's another view that says that there is an intelligence that permeates the entire universe, that mm-hmm. guided the unfoldment of, I mean, you know, you look at the universe, and I don't know about you, but I have trouble thinking it's just physics at work. I mean, you're talking, you know, a couple of 100 billion galaxies, all of whom have, like, you know, 300, you know, 500 billion stars in them, you know, with planets all over the place. I mean, you know, to me, it's really hard to imagine that that's simply a physical process at work, you know.
Right.
And when you see the richness and diversity of life on this planet, it's really hard for me to not see the work of a creative, intelligent energy or force that is present in everything.
Exactly.
That maybe has sufficient intelligence and power to bring other types of corrections to the system. And maybe that's one of the things that we're sensing, those of us who are meditating and praying, that we sense a correction coming.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of material on that, that at some point, if we fail in our stewardship, you know, those of us who don't want to roll up our sleeves and get to work will be shoved aside in the same way that, say, it was the end of the dinosaurs' time and they were simply shoved aside, and those little creatures, you know, that scurried about in the underbrush, the mammals, took over a planet that had been dominated by reptiles for hundreds of millions of years.
Right.
You know, we're all talking about mega corporations and the dehumanization that they are bringing into the world, and they look as though they're getting so powerful. Well, guess what? The rest of the world is starting to push back. They're starting to say, we don't want these mega corporations dominating our economic life, you know, plundering our natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
There's a counter movement beginning to this kind of, you know, profiteering, you know, self-aggrandizing materialism that organizes itself almost like the Borg in Star Trek. You know, I don't know if you're a Star Trek fan, but I think Gene Roddenberry did a wonderful job of setting in motion a show that could let us explore ideas about other life and other civilizations in the world, and therefore look at our own from a unique perspective. And you know, this idea in Star Trek of the Borg, these half-humans, half-machines that live in a hive in a big cube, you know, in their cubicles. If that's starting to sound familiar, folks, you know, it's like what we're becoming, you know. And you know, the fact that our children are on antidepressant drugs and are increasingly angry and violent and showing sometimes psychotic tendencies and are becoming obese and isolated. And, I mean, I see so many kids now with their own personal iPods and CD players just tuning the world out.
Right.
And when you sit them down with an old person, with an elder who has stories to tell about their life and wisdom to pass on, I mean, you've got 5 minutes of their attention span and then that's it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they're gone. They're back to their room, to their internet, and to their all their electronics. I don't know about you, but that's not a world that I want to pass on to the future.
Certainly not how I want to raise my child, I can tell you.
Oh, man. You know, I mean, I sat at the feet of all my grandparents, but especially my grandmothers, and they had witnessed the Great Depression. They had witnessed immigration. They had They had witnessed World War One, World War Two.
Mm-hmm.
The advent of the telephone, of airplanes, and traveling across continents. The
first gas lamp being lit on the street.
Yeah, you know, I heard so much wisdom from them about how to cope with catastrophic change, with dramatic change, and hold your spiritual center, and hold close to your values. And I think, you know, that's one of the messages of the Earth changes is, yes, there's a lot going on, and we are having an impact on our planet that we need to really bring to the center of our public discussion about the future and mm-hmm. what we can do in the present to have a more green and sustainable lifestyle as a human being that will allow resources to be more fairly allocated to the entire human race. Because if we can do that, if we can learn to live with just a little less so that people can have just a little more, we will find an easing of tension, you know, that will buy us the time to act collectively as a species to begin to make repairs to this lifeboat before it does maybe capsize on us and plunge us into something very, very serious. One of the global warming prospects is that a change in ocean currents due to global warming could shut off the mechanism that keeps Northern Europe fairly temperate. Most people don't know that Great Britain is at the same latitude as Alaska. And the only reason it's not like Alaska is because it benefits from the natural warming that occurs when water from the equator makes its way northward and eastward at the Gulf Stream. Well, there are indications that the melting of the North Pole, which is proceeding fairly rapidly, could shut down that mechanism. And if that were to happen, you could see Northern Europe fall into a mini ice age and suddenly, you know, have, you know, freezing cold temperatures and, of course, problems with obtaining energy and taking care of those large populations. You could destabilize Europe and then the regions around it. So that's how serious some of these problems are that we're talking about.
You had said in one of your writings that I saw that hurricanes over the last 35 years of a Category 4 and 5 has doubled. Wind speed duration has increased 50%, and we may be experiencing Category 6 hurricanes.
Yes.
Now, I'm wondering, could you give us an idea, just to maybe give an impact or a kick in the pants or whatever you want to call it, to people to understand what would a Category 6 hurricane look like?
Holy. Cow, you don't even want to think about it. I mean, you know, when Katrina was a Category 5, and you could see what it did to New Orleans.
Exactly.
They just recently had one in Northeast Australia that was pretty serious. A Category 6 hurricane, first off, because there would be so much energy in it and such high wind speeds, you know, over 200 mile an hour wind speeds, with enormous atmospheric energy tied up in it, it would travel a much longer distance, doing a lot more damage. The thing that we're starting to see in global warming is that if more energy is retained in the Earth's atmosphere, the energy that comes initially from the sun, that energy has to be dissipated, and it gets dissipated through a very complex circulatory mechanism, part of which is storm systems that take heat and cold and mix it violently in a way that releases tremendous amounts of thermal energy in the atmosphere. If global warming keeps heating up the equator like it's doing now, we're going to see these storms being fueled by so much more heat energy that their power is going to be, I mean, you're talking about wrecking, you know, entire island nations, you know, getting hit by a Category 6 hurricane, like in the Caribbean or, you know, even coastal parts of the United States. A Category 6 hurricane coming up the coast of the United States and slamming into some of our coastal regions in the mid-Atlantic states or even higher. I mean, you know, this is not something people want to even think about having to clean up after. You know, we're already looking at an insurance industry that is getting into financial trouble because of the rising cost of natural disasters. A Category 6 hurricane would be like, you know, 4 or 5 Katrinas in terms of damage.
So they'd make a tsunami look like a walk in the park.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. You know,
I don't mean to rush you along. I'm noticing that we're running out of time.
And okay.
We have to stop pretty soon here.
We're
okay for a little while, but I didn't want to get off of here with you without talking about Maggie's Place.
Yes, thank you.
If you could tell me about how the people can get in touch with your place there, the B&B Retreat Center, what you teach there, what people can benefit from by either going there or by contacting you or your wife.
Sure. I feel that spiritually we were guided here to provide a place that would help people to reconnect with nature, with the earth. I mean, here we are. We are in the Smoky Mountains in the Catawba bioregion, which is an internationally designated bioregion, what is also called the sea cradle of North America. You know, when the Ice Age came through North America, it scoured the earth, you know, from our northernmost borders to almost Virginia. But at that point, equilibrium was reached. And when the glaciers began to melt back and recede, and of course the land had been scraped clean. I mean, there was 1,000 feet of ice over Manhattan. Okay, mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about here. The seeds from plants and trees that recolonized the newly bare soil, much of it came from the Smoky Mountains. So this area is a very sacred and profound area for North America, and I felt like we were guided here to help people to reconnect with the sacredness of this area, the forests here that stretch for hundreds of miles in all directions, the abundant wildlife and plants that are here, the sacred areas that were sacred to the native peoples here. One of the things we do is take people to a few areas that we have connected with personally as areas that have become sacred to us. And we do some spiritual processes there that help people reconnect with the Earth Mother and with the divine sacred energy of the Earth, and therefore with their own soul, with an awareness of their own divine being, their existence as a spirit that is taking a journey through the material plane, but that ultimately returns to a higher dimension. Once one is aware of one's soul, one is able to act from a different place than not knowing of one's own spiritual power. And therefore, when people come here, one of the experiences that we try to help them to have is this recovery of the self, this ability to step back from the system, from the Borg system, and say, no, wait, I do not wish to become a half person, half machine. I am a human being. I am a child of God, in fact, the almighty God of creation. And I need to find out what my soul came into this world to do and how I can best serve my creator in some positive way to help humanity to step back from the brink and have a much longer view than the imminent apocalypse, but to recognize that our world is several billion years old, that our sun has several billion years of life left in it, and that if we are good stewards, we have been promised life everlasting, mm-hmm. which I interpret as we keep coming back here, you know,
yeah.
Lifetime after lifetime. Is that something that you yourself feel about your own existence, that you've been here before?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I believe that I have at least 7 Native American experiences. So I have a definite spiritual connection to the earth.
Wow. I mean, I think more and more people are starting to discover that. The risk that people took in the 60s and the early 70s in the civil rights movement, in the anti-war demonstrations, in moving our society towards being more authentic in its proclamation of human rights, those risks that people took, I think, came from a place within them that allows us to take risks because we are aware of our spiritual permanence.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dr. King was an incredible example of a person able to face enormous adversity weaponless, you know, armed only with his spiritual faith. And you know, what an inspiration to everyone. What we're here to do is to provide a place where people can begin to make a transition away from the way they're living now, you know, materialistic, consumer-oriented, kind of reactionary to what the system demands of them, to a more proactive place of trying to identify their soul's purpose in the world and getting busy with taking steps in the direction of fulfilling that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I think what people will be surprised to find is that once they make a commitment to a spiritual path and to accepting guidance from their higher self, that they start to get help in ways they could never have imagined, to reach goals that they never thought they could possibly achieve. And they come in contact with people who are like-minded, and so this enormous potentialities come together to bring about change.
Exactly. You raise your vibration, and you will be attracting people with that vibration.
That's the law that seems to be in effect there. And I think what people will find here in the Smokies is a lot of people are gravitating here. We found out about a year or so ago that one of the reasons is there is one of the most sacred places on the Earth's surface is only a few miles from here. It's listed in the Keys of Enoch, which is a pretty powerful metaphysical book. And folks have started making pilgrimages to this place. In fact, for the summer equinox, we'll be doing a ceremony there, gathering people to drum and to sing, to dance, and to pray for guidance on what steps each of us need to take in the years ahead to move in the direction of greater sustainability and stewardship. That's what we're trying to encourage.
So if a person wanted to go to Maggie's place, what would they need to do?
I would look at our website and get a sense of who Maggie and I are and what, you know, what our beliefs are, what our history is. You know, Maggie's a psychotherapist, you know, my background in science and the arts. If they go to our website at www.outdoorfun.com and then follow the link to Maggie's place, they can learn all about
it. Excuse me, I hate to interrupt, but you can go longer because my co-host, Winfrey, I can't reach him, so I would like to extend that time to you two. So
thank
keep
you.
Going. I will let you know if I get in contact with them. How's that?
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Carry on.
Thank you. You know, so if they'll go to follow the link to Maggie's place, they can really learn a lot about us, our philosophy, what kinds of projects are going on here. Those of you who are cultural creatives, you know, we have a little program where we allow you to come up here. We work within whatever budget you have. You know, this is not about making money. This is about the most important thing in the world, which is your own soul and your soul's journey through the world. And we try to introduce you to other cultural creatives that might inspire you to make changes in your life.
When you come to the bed and breakfast, do you have classes that you teach there?
Not really a class. We don't consider ourselves teachers. You know, we consider that we're all on this journey together. We all have different awarenesses and experiences. What we do is we simply create an environment that inspires, possibly for some people, new experiences, like a community drum circle. You know, how many people have gone to someone's house and sat in a circle with drums and simply drummed, and then, you know, maybe felt inspired to get up and dance and express some new awarenesses and feelings in movement, and then perhaps to sing, people who don't think they can sing, to suddenly find their voice, to go to sacred sites and begin to sense this energy. There's a sacred energy that some of our ancestors were very much aware of, and they built temples and shrines and markers to indicate places where there was exceptionally powerful spiritual energies that could be used to accelerate one's spiritual development. The Smokies are full of sites like this. You know, there are people who have come here. I've heard stories of people who, one lady said she she had her crystal on her altar, and, you know, one day the crystal told her that, you know, to get start packing because she was going somewhere, and she said, put me on your dashboard and I'll guide you there. And it guided this person here to Asheville in the Smoky Mountains.
You know, there are so many people out there who would think that the person needed to have medication.
Sure,
say
sure.
Things like that. And it's so sad because mm-hmm. I know, I mean, I'm putting myself right out there in the line by saying this, but I have been guided myself by so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I don't have mental problems. I myself am a psychotherapist also.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so sad that people will not connect with themselves, with the universe, to be able to understand that there is this connection and that you need to be guided by these things.
Absolutely.
It's there for a reason.
Oh, I mean, I have a short, since we have a little more time, I'd love to pass this brief story on to you, which is the reason we even left New York, that we left a very comfortable income, our family, our friends, our
okay.
Careers.
Sorry about that. Winfrey did call.
Oh, no.
So I'll let you close, and I thank you.
Okay.
Okay, just to wrap that up, it was a fox that guided us and told us that the environment we were living in was dying around us, but we couldn't see it. And once we realized that got us to come to this island of life that's the Smoky Mountains.
Well, Alan, it looks like we need to come to a close.
Yeah.
So I am going to say that if Rochelle is agreeable to this, and I'm sure she will be, we'd love to have you back.
Oh, I would love to talk some more. I've got a ton of things I'd love to share.
This was incredible, and I hope that our viewing audience enjoyed this the same. So I'd like to thank you, Alan, for being my guest today. It was an absolute pleasure having you and listening to your insightful words of wisdom. And thank you to our producer, Don Newsom. And the Don and Wynn show is up next, and we will be having on our show Lee Carroll. She channels Cryon. She's the author of The Indigo Children. It's a wonderful and exciting topic, so I hope that everybody can be here again. And until then, this is Eliza Desertil in Vermont hosting for Rochelle Sparrow for the Rochelle Sparrow Connection. Thank you and good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.